Hello and welcome to Ditching Hourly. I'm Jonathan Stark. And today I am joined again by the lovely and talented Blair Enns. Blair, welcome to the show.
A lot of inflection in the again. It's like, here's again. Blair again. I am happy to be here, Jonathan. Thank you.
Always great to talk to you. The topic for today is productizing your services, or productized services, however you want to call it. I think we were chatting about this on Twitter in a thread of somebody else's tweet, but
that's how I get on your podcast. Like, oh, that's a wrong thing he just tweeted. Let's get him on the show and we'll talk about it.
Well, that's where I try. Twitter's a good place to go to test your thinking on something, because you can just blurt something out and everybody will tell you why you're wrong, and then you can see if you think they're correct in your error or if you're like, no, I'm right.
Yep,
it's good for that. So this has been on my mind. We didn't talk about this before the show, but this has been on my mind a lot because I'm working on a book about the subtitle being 35 Ways to Stop Trading Time for Money. And so productized services fit into that heavily. There's some other things too, but productized services, I think on balance, are the easiest way out for most of the people that I work with. There's pros and cons to everything, but anyway, so I've got a lot of examples of different kinds of productized services. And I just wanted to kind of brainstorm with you what you are seeing in your space, because we're sort of serving different spaces, what you're seeing there, what's working, what's common, those sorts of things. And we can just sort of fill in gaps on both sides, just kind of have a regular conversation. And hopefully the listener will enjoy sort of eavesdropping on it.
Sounds good.
Cool. All right. So... let's start here. What is a productized service in your mind? Look at definition.
Yeah, good question. A productized service is one. So I think of productized and customized services. Mm-hmm. A productized service is a service that is not customized. It is standard, off the shelf, templated, boilerplate, etc. And you do not bend it to the uniqueness of the business to which you are delivering it.
Yeah.
Now, that's you could push back on that a little bit and say, well, in any productized service there might be some sort of customization. I don't know, that wouldn't be true, but I'll stand by that definition. You don't bend it to the audience.
Right. Yeah, you just say no, this isn't for you. I mean, I'll speak to that point a little bit, because I think it can cause confusion for people. A productized service will be delivered like a service. In other words, you're going to be having like a one-on-one interaction with a client. It's not like a video course that they just download and you don't have any interaction with them. It's a high touch delivery, but it's delivered in a very structured way that you don't deviate from. There will be differences, of course, because it's like personalized to them. So you're not going to be saying the exact same thing every time in every situation. Because then it could be a product, then it could just be a video. But there's still going to be some creativity or improvisation within your framework. At least that's the way I see it mostly happening. And what I equate it to is like ordering an iPod. When you order an iPod, there's some selections that or whatever. You can make some selections, and then you can have like, do you want it engraved? And like the engraving is customized, but it's not fundamentally changing the nature of the iPod. It's not even changing something important. In fact, it's just a part of the process that someone is allowed to customize it with an engraving. So it won't be the experience when delivering a productized service will be unique. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It's unique each time because the client is unique each time. It's a different person. They're going to have a different conversation with you, but it's important to stick with your process and your scope and what your promise is each time. Otherwise, you lose all the benefits of having a productized service in the first place. Do you disagree with any of that?
I'm not sure. What are the benefits of a productized service? What are the benefits mm-hmm. To the customer?
To the customer, the benefits to the customer is that they're being taken through something that's been road tested before. So they're not the guinea pig for some new process or service, like it will be fat, it'll be delivered, almost certainly it will be delivered faster with higher quality than it would be if it was just a custom project that's like, hey, I'm good at mobile web development. Let's talk about me doing some mobile web development for you. What do you need? You know? So in the deliver from the delivery standpoint, once they've made the purchase, I think it's going to go much more quickly. They're going to get much more bang for the buck than if you were just winging it as a smart person with a client who had a need.
So,
Yeah, go ahead.
those benefits of delivered more quickly, more bang for the buck, those are efficiency based benefits.
Well, I see it more as like an opportunity cost benefit. So it's an efficiency benefit to the seller, but you're asking about the buyer. So to the buyer, it's like, wouldn't you want this outcome more quickly? Wouldn't you want this high quality outcome more quickly than less quickly? So, you know, quicker time to market, you could say, is like a very clear business benefit that any business person would desire. Usually, when people would come to me for some kind of a custom engagement, they would be like, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and have it done in one day, we'd be even happier than if it took 18 months. So I think that a productized service can deliver as a result more quickly than if someone's just winging it, then that's good for that's going to be preferable to the client in every case.
But I don't think those are opposite ends of the spectrum. Like I think one of the things a client gets when they hire an expert, so a specialist, is the fact that they've worked in this space before, the fact that they can see the patterns more readily, they can arrive at outcomes quickly. But that's not necessarily tied to productization. If you don't mind, I'll back up a bit and just paint the picture between the distinction between productized services and customized services a little bit more, because I think it was that something I said on Twitter that prompted you to invite me to have this conversation. And I probably said something like, it's a mistake to productize your services if you run a customized services firm.
That would have definitely caused me to put you on the show. Okay, yeah, flesh
Yeah,
that out.
so if we want to get to the heart of my message is don't productize your services. Now, there are some exceptions to that. And as I said to you before we pressed record, I recognize there are some holes in my thinking. So I'm looking forward to the conversation where maybe we can kind of identify where those holes are and sort out what's wrong or how to plug the gaps or have me rethink my ideas on this. So you think of a customized services firm and a product, so let me start with the audience that I serve, creative firm. So a design firm, ad agency, and then all of the like hybrid consulting software engineering. Like our we you said we serve different markets, but those markets are merging, right?
Coalescing, yep.
So let's take a design firm. Small number of clients. This is how a design firm or an ad agency should work. We have a small number of clients. Every client is unique. Every problem that they have that they bring to us is a unique opportunity for us to help them create value in a way that is unique to them. Therefore, every engagement is a blank slate.
This is the way you think an agency should work?
Yes,
Okay,
also
keep
how
going.
a consultant should work. Every engagement is a blank slate of opportunity to create value that is specific to their client and very unique situation in the market that they serve. And we should be thinking creatively and expansively about how we help this client create value. And as you know, in a value conversation, we're trying to uncover, well, we're actually transcending the problem and solution as the client states it to us, and we're thinking bigger and we're getting them to think bigger. But well, what is it you want to be true in the future? And what's the value of this? And what will you measure? What's the value of this? What would you be willing to pay for that? So that's a value conversation for somebody who's selling customized services. And everything is the engagement is unique and bespoke. Therefore, the proposal is unique and bespoke. Therefore, every proposal is a unique creative act. Every price is a unique creative act.
Yeah, totally agree on all of that, yes.
So that was
Except for the should. I agree on all of that except for the should.
Okay,
This
so
is
we
how
can come back to
agencies
that.
should, right?
Yeah, so this is how agencies should work. This is how consultants should work. I used to be a consultant and I didn't really work that way. I'd productize my services. I'd quasi-productize my services. The other end of the spectrum is a training company. So I used to be a consultant and I run a training company now. And a training company, so we talk about in a customized services firm, value-based pricing is tied to, you're not, is it is more art than science.
I'd say it's 100% art. But
Yeah. Well, there's a little bit of math that I would put into the cat that I would put in the category of science, rightly or
Fair
wrongly.
enough. Fair enough.
But when it comes to a product company or a productized services company, it is more science than art. So they say there are 90,000 data points that go into the price of an airline seat, as an example. And so when you have huge volume scale because you're selling products or productized services, then it's more scientific. And how do you price based on value? You have to do these fairly sophisticated segmentation studies where you understand, well, we've got different, our audience of thousands or millions is made up of these groups, these types, these personas. And this group over here values these things and they're willing to pay this much for it. And this group over here values these things and they're willing to pay much less for it, et cetera. So you build your products and your prices based on this data where you are making assumptions about. You're grouping people together based on their similarities. And then you're creating a product and a price that is targeted towards the average of that segment.
Totally. Coach, business class, and first class, right?
Yeah. So that's a productized services business. And in a, when you sell a productized service, and I've sold both customize and productize, so I can attest to the veracity of the statement. When you're selling a customized service and you have learned to master the value conversation, you go into the conversation with the client not thinking about what you're going to sell to them.
100%
It's not
agree.
about you,
Totally.
it's about the client, and you become really focused on the client in a way that productized salespeople cannot be,
True.
because you're letting go of solutions completely and you're focused on what do you want? What will we measure? What's the value of getting this? If I could help you do this, what would you be willing to pay?
Sure.
As soon as you start productizing your services, now you have these things, these products on the shelf behind you. Client starts talking, you ask them, what do you want? They start talking, and you, being a pattern matching machine, being a subject matter expert, you see the patterns and you jump ahead and you think, oh, I know what you want. I've seen this problem before. And you immediately start matching your products to the client's solution. And you quit
I have a
listening. This,
hammer, you are a
yeah,
nail.
this is no, and I do this now because we are a training company. And we can sell you a seat in a workshop. We can sell you a seat in a boot camp. We can sell you private training. We can sell you private coaching. And that's about it. So, client starts talking. I immediately start thinking which product is best for them. All of these things
If
have,
any.
if any, yeah. And all of these things have prices attached to them. And a productized salesperson has to think this way because they have to move quickly. Why do they have to move quickly? Because they have to pursue scale. Why do they have to pursue scale? Because one of the client things the client gets in giving up customization is they get a lower price. So your business model has to support higher scale, lower prices. This is a culturally different business than a customized services firm. And I said there are some holes in my thinking here where there isn't, there are places where a customized services firm can have productized some products, and we can talk about that a little bit. But fundamentally, these two businesses are at odds with each other. So let's go back to the and the culture of the business. One is an efficiency-seeking organization, one is an innovation-seeking and value creation-seeking organization. And I've coined the term the inefficiency principle, a blend of the words innovation and efficiency, to talk about this problem that you can't be both. So the inefficiency principle is the idea that innovation and efficiency are mutually opposable goals.
Yes.
And you cannot increase one without decreasing the other.
Right, because creativity is inherently inefficient.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't considered this before, you will push back on this idea. But it's got some holes in it, some nuance, but it's a pretty sound idea.
Yeah, you're the first person I heard that from. And I remember it. I was like, wow, yes, right. So I suppose, yeah, we could go into that, but that's not the point of today's talk. So I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I think this does boil down to the types of clients that we serve, because I mostly serve soloists. And let me back up for a second. I definitely agree that there are fundamentally different dynamics at play when you are selling, when you are trying to value price custom projects. You're sort of idealized firm model where they're doing creative, innovative work. They don't want to be repeating anything. They don't want to be selling anything. They just want to be learning about, you know, what is the transformation that we're trying to achieve here. The productized thing, you know, I have a hammer, everything is a nail, is a different mindset. It is. And I know I have plenty of evidence that, and I imagine it's easier for soloists, like a solo .NET developer, an expert at .NET or Rails or something like that. When you've just got a solo person who was a freelancer building themselves up by the hour, it is not difficult for them to sell a productized service that is a precursor to doing more of a value-based project that is unique and different and it doesn't have a defined scope. It has a defined outcome. But it's easier for them actually than going from hourly billing straight to value price projects, because they always underbid the projects. So it's extremely dangerous for someone who's been billing by the hour, a software developer that's billing by the hour, that has been billing by the hour for 5 or 10 years, to immediately switch to fixed price projects that they think they are value pricing, but they will surely not do a good job value pricing the first 2 or 3 times, which could easily put them out of business. So if they go into a value conversation, and mine's less involved than yours, you've got like 5 different types of conversations or something. But mine is just like the why conversation. Go in and ask these questions. You need to have these answers by the time you're done. If you don't have those answers, you can't do a proposal. You will put yourself out of business. You'll regret it at the very least. So what you need to propose to them is, it's like, look, you couldn't answer these really important questions. So what I propose is we do a discovery phase with, I'll do a diagnostic. I will make, I'll do discovery. I'll make recommendations. I'll create a roadmap. And then we can de-risk this completely hazy project that you're going to spend 6 figures on for sure. Let's make sure it's in the 6 figures and not 7 by coming up with some clarity around what exactly you're trying to achieve, how you will measure the success of that, how we'll measure progress along the way, making sure there's buy-in among the rest of the staff, the stakeholders, some of your customers maybe even. So my folks don't see this. They don't see it as a productized service. It is a productized service, but they don't see
it. The diagnostic.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's the one product every customized services firm should have.
Okay, so we're on the same page there. Because they don't see it that way. They see it as like, oh, well, I would have done this for free just to write a proposal before.
Yeah.
Or they'll say, I would have just done this as the first month of the hourly assignment.
Yes.
And then found out that the thing they want isn't feasible or something, or it's going to be, you know, 10 times more expensive than they thought, and then it's just a waste of money. So we agree that that is a productized service that a custom firm could have. Another one is just a straight up, like, I'm an expert at a thing and you can pay $1,000 to pick my brain for an hour, which is just the most brain dead, simple productized service that you could possibly.
I did that when I was a consultant, single issue, single session guidance. Mm-hmm. One phone call, $1,000.
Exactly.
Up to an hour, no preparation in advance,
exactly.
No report afterwards.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. If you want to report, take notes.
Yeah. Alan Weiss.
Right. So, yeah. So, those two things. So, I think when we get into some of the specifics, I think what we're finding is that when we get into the specifics of like what kind of productized service are we talking about here, then there is some wiggle room and some nuance that between the two stances. I
Yeah, so
think,
if I can
yeah.
recap what you've said, because I agree with both of those points. So the first one is a diagnostic is a formalized way of gathering information about the project so that you can scope it and price it. And you sell a diagnostic. And in a lot of customized services business, most of the engagements begin with a diagnostic because the client doesn't have the baseline data, or they don't even have the goals. Usually it's they don't have baseline data. They don't have an accurate understanding of where they are now. Sometimes they don't have an accurate picture of where they want to get to or the value of getting there. So you get paid to find out to go get that. You get paid to go get the information that's required for you to be able to scope and price this project. And so you should have a formalized methodology for doing so. And as you refer to it the same way I do, it's a diagnostic. That should be formalized. I believe it should be written up in one page and it should be standardized. So when you propose to move forward on that first phase diagnostic, you can slide the piece of paper across the table or email it to the client and say, well, here's what it looks like. What I wouldn't do is I wouldn't standardize the price. I would not put a price in that document. I would stick with the first rule of pricing creativity in my book, which I got from Ron Baker, which is price the client. So have changed the price based on willingness to pay and your rudimentary assessment of the value of that to the client.
Yes.
So, and that's number one. And number two, just again, I feel like I'm interviewing you here, but number two, just the, you know, it's especially for a soloist, this like, okay, I have this thing. Like if you just sounds like you just need some advice. I have this thing. It's like it's X dollars and it looks like this. And here are it's very the lines are very clearly delineated. So again, my example was it's 1 hour. No, don't send me, you can send me stuff in advance, but I'm not going to read it until the clock is ticking. We're both on the phone together. And you pay in advance and et cetera. If you want another hour after that, and it can't be some low hourly rate. It's got to be something crazy, like, you know, if you look at, it really has to be tied to some rudimentary tie to value. It's got to be way beyond any hourly rate you would charge as a coder.
Yeah, you just price it such that you attract first class flyers.
Yeah, and I
Right.
can think of one other type of productized service that would make sense.
Okay, hit me.
I think of a feeder product. So,
Like an MVP.
no, like, so in my own business, back when I was a consultant, I had a webcast subscription for 10 years. I had webcast
I
subscriptions.
was a
And
customer.
yeah, that's right. And that was a great, so I published blog posts on a regular basis. That was free, so lots of people reading free blog posts. The next step is pay a little bit of money to go deeper into these topics in a webcast. And those people who are willing to part with some money are more valuable, more likely to pay you for the higher value stuff. So it's a great feeder product that, or kind of a next step. It's a first paying step that lets you decide. All these people who've been reading my blog post for years, and have never bought, and let's see if they'll buy something from me. And those that don't buy that feeder product from you, that is productized, scaled, delivered at scale, far less likely to hire you for your more valuable services. But I think those three, beyond those three, I think productizing your services is a mistake. It's not one that you'll burn in hell for. You won't necessarily crush your business. You and I know somebody who has no employees and he will bill $1.5 million this year, no employees, and all his services are productized. I have a friend who is another solo consultant who's one of the best value pricers I've ever met. He will bill just under that amount, no employees, works far less, has far fewer clients. So when you have the volume, you can get away with productization. You're leaving money on the table. This friend of mine is going to bill $1.5 million. He knows he could change the way he prices and he could earn $2-3 million, but he's been doing this for years. He doesn't need to earn $2-3 million, $4 million, $5 million.
Right.
And those value conversations, that's a steep learning curve.
Exactly. Yes. We are 100% on the same page. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes it's just, and it's easier price. It's like, hey, here's the price. I'm in demand. Here's the price, pay it or leave it.
Yeah.
Rather than, well, I'll tell you what the price is once I figure out how much value I can create, what that's worth to you. Like that's like, if you have all these people lining up, willing to pay you money and you want to move quickly and you don't want to go deep into your client engagements. Now with your audience, they have to go deep, but if you're the type of person where you don't really like people, and you don't want to go too deep with them too long, yeah, stay productized, pursue volume. But that's the key. Like the key to productized services is volume. The trade-off has to be volume. You have to increase volume, not just a little bit, not just like 4 or 5 clients from a solopreneur to 10, 12. Like it's dozens, it's hundreds, it's sometimes it's thousands.
Not for a solo. Yeah.
But it would certainly be dozens, probably over 100 where it starts to make sense.
Right.
And I just want to put a finer point on this. So the client gets a cheaper price because the advice is not customized to them. It's not customized to them because you're effectively segmenting your audience and you're aiming at the average of the segment. Now behind me on my bookshelf is a book called The End of Average. There's another book. I'm looking for it. There's another book on averages and it might not be The End of Average. Maybe it is. Interesting studies in this book where they look at all these effectively segmentation studies. They start with like designing a cockpit. So the US Air Force designs a cockpit to the average pilot's dimensions and they measure 20,000 pilots and these planes keep crashing and they can't figure out why. So they go look at the 20,000 people in the study and they ask themselves, how many of these pilots actually meet the average? The answer, zero.
They're all bigger and smaller.
When you are building a product and setting a price to an average, you're approximately correct for everybody. You're precisely correct for nobody. And in exchange for that, not getting precisely correct advice is a lower price. For your lower price business model to work, you need scale. So I really became aware of this in digital marketing firms. So there is a type of digital marketing firm out there that is a channel partner of a SaaS product. And I won't name names here. So they are a digital marketing firm. They resell a SaaS product.
Yep, I get it.
And the SaaS product that they sell has done such a good job of supporting their agency partners. They've given them all of this like turnkey content to put out into the world. It's like these people are more like franchisees than they are like entrepreneurs. And they take so many of their business decision-making cues from this SaaS company, including, and I'm sure the SaaS company didn't advocate this, they price like SaaS companies. So when you go to I can tell that they're a reseller of this product because I go to their website and they have these productized services pricing. So they're violating rule number one of pricing creativity, price the client. And what they don't understand, and when you look at, and I have a friend who's done consulting for dozens of these firms, they are far less profitable than the average digital marketing firm.
When you say profitable, you literally mean profits or you mean revenue?
Profit. They are far less profitable. They make far less money. Even the ones at the highest tier that are kind of famous within the spectrum, they don't make the money that those below looking up at them covetously think.
Right.
And the big problem is they are taking their cue from a productized from a product company that has massive scale. They're pricing the same way, but none of them have the volume. They don't have the capacity. These businesses do not scale in the same way.
That's a good point, capacity.
And that is the most common mistake that I see. It's in digital marketing firms in particular.
Well, it's a business model mismatch. I mean, one's a product company and one's a productized services company, or a services company, really. And I mean, that's just a complete mismatch.
But I pivoted Win Without Pitching from a consulting company to a training company in 2013. Mm-hmm. And it was easier. It's not as messy as consulting, but there's the first few years until you hit scale. It's like you really need a certain amount of scale, and you really need to build some infrastructure from this, and you really need to build an organization where that is more efficiency seeking than a pure innovation seeking customized services firm.
Right. It ends up boiling down to like, what kind of business do you want to build? Because that one example notwithstanding, you can make plenty of money as a productized service business. You can. I mean, is it as much money as you could make if you were just selling custom?
Well, you could make more, but you need the scale.
Right. So I guess the way
if you're a soloist, where's that? And you're struggling with 3, 4, 5 clients or whatever it is at any one time. Like, how do you flick the switch to get to 100, 200, 300, 400?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think in Teen Zo's book, Subscribed, he calls it swallowing the fish, or he talks about it there, where you're going from you're used to high revenue. So let me just talk about solos for a second in case it's different. I think it is meaningfully different than having like 20 or 30 employees, because you can focus on different things in a different way. But if you are used to making $200 an hour and billing out 30 or 40 hours a week, which is not totally uncommon, and then I say to somebody like, oh, you should start a mailing list and send out email like 5 days a week, you know, and they're like, well, that'll take me 2 hours a day. That's 10 hours a week. I could have made, you know, 200 times 10 hours, and I'm losing 200 times 10 hours unless I do it on the weekend, or, you know, queue them up on the weekend or something. So there's this kind of you know, scrunched up puppy face, like, why would I do that? Because they're so used to trading time for money. So for me, switching straight to value pricing is extremely dangerous if they're going to take on a really big project, because they will get the conversation wrong. They will underbid it, guaranteed, every time, 100%. So if they take on a huge project, and the projects that they're getting leads for, they get like 2 leads a year, maybe 4 leads a year, they land one of them or two of them, and they last for 6 to 12 months. So if they take on one of those and they value price it, they can really get in trouble, you know, because they're gonna think they're value pricing it, but they're really doing time and materials in disguise. And they try and figure out the scope. They don't find out what the success criteria is. They don't find out what a project, a progress metric is. And they think they're doing it, but they're actually way underbidding it. And then they hate it because they did a time materials bid, and those almost always go poorly. You know, it's like more than 50% of the time. So when I talk to someone but they see they're on the hamster wheel, and it's like, geez, I'm like 50. I've been doing this for 20 years, and my lifestyle is outstripping, you know, my lifestyle increases are outstripping my ability to raise my hourly rate, or I'm at a ceiling on what I can charge for my rate, or there are kids coming out of college that are undercutting me by 50% and they're actually really good. So, you know, it gets very scary. So like, what do I do? So for me, it's the big question to me is to them is, do you want to become a student of sales? Do you want to become good at sales? Because the value conversation is like a performance art, and you're not going to get good at it without practice. So they don't even have the scale of leads to practice it. So what do you do? Like, they're not getting any leads. So I'm like, well, let's start doing this paid diagnostic. Let's start doing these paid phone calls and see if you can get anybody in. And both of those things, the phone call actually is a really good filter for paying clients like you described with the webcast subscription. If someone's going to pay you $1,000 to pick your brain about image compression on like, I don't know, in a CDN, then they really have a problem. Like, they've got something wrong. And if you're an expert at image compression or something, then they're going to be like, oh, wow, that was amazing. I'm so glad I talked to you. Listen, can we bring you in? It's like, okay, let's do a paid diagnostic. I'll figure out what's going on here. And then at that point, maybe they've got enough information to do a st and I'm like, make the phase as small as possible. Do a phase one that's as small as possible, not what you're used to, which is trying to get as many hours as possible and blowing the scope up big because you're taking no risk, but make it really small and just try and execute on that so you get more and more chance to have these value conversations because you have to have practice to get better at it. Okay, so sorry for the soapbox, but the point is, if they don't ever want to get better at sales, they hate the idea of it. They wish it would just sell itself. I'm like, don't bother trying to get good at value pricing. You're never going to get there. So
Don't
it's
bother
like,
trying to get good at business.
that's a fair point, but they can still do really well if they are like productize a very specific thing, and then from there build out products underneath it, products, not productized services, but products, and those will scale like crazy. So the question is like, what kind of business model do you want to have? Do you want to be like super innovative? Like, I mean, I love your description. A small number of unique clients are coming to you all the time with these problems, and you are like massively inefficient creative that is never going to optimize the way that things work. And you're going to have a genius idea in the shower or whatever.
And you don't
And
need to because the delta d between your cost and the price is so massive, you don't even, you could scope in orders of magnitude.
exactly. Totally agree. So where am I going with this? So it boils down to what kind of business do you want to have? If you're, especially for soloists, it's very difficult for me to even think beyond soloists. I've worked with a couple of small firms and it's relatively similar, but if you start getting up to like 100 or 200 employees, I can't even relate. So it's like,
So you're not seeing, this is why we're thinking about this differently. You're not seeing a productized services as a scaled offering sold to many. You're
no.
seeing it as a safety or an interim step
Yes.
to get away from hourly pricing to
Yeah.
value-based pricing.
Either way, I see it as an interim step either to get to value pricing or to get to product.
Yeah, so I like to say that I think that makes sense. I like to say that pricing is a prison cell in your own mind of your own making. And at first, when you learn value-based pricing, you're going to think that you have dissolved the walls of the cell, but you haven't. You've just made them bigger. And I recall a conversation I had with one of my earliest clients. I worked with this firm in 2003, and I was having drinks with them in 20 with two people, two senior people from that firm. They weren't owners. They'd since gone on to other things. And I was having drinks with them in 2019, so 16 years later. And we were reminiscing about when we worked together. We were all kids. And they said to me, I remember you gave us the one piece of pricing advice. You said did this one service. I think it was branding. And we were charging $15,000 for it. You said double the price every time you sell it. So we sold the next one at 30,000, the next one at 60, the next one at 120, and the next one at 240. The exact same service. And they're laughing, like just reliving this moment. And I'm thinking, yeah, that was bad advice. And then I realized it wasn't bad advice. It was good advice at the time. But there's If you move to value-based pricing, it's like, you know what? That's an example of the size of the prison well. You're just doubling the size of the cell with every sale. But at some point, there's a next level where the walls disappear and the price is really dependent on the value that you create. So they could have been, while they were earning multiples of what they had previously earned for that service, they could have been earning multiples more in some cases. Maybe not, but in some cases, they almost certainly could have been earning multiples more if they'd thought about it and priced it correctly. But that's messy. That's complex. You need to learn to master the value conversation, all of these things. So the idea of just saying, okay, that service that you do, let's productize it. Let's say, okay, if you buy this, you get these things. And I used to do this when I was selling design. And here's the price. And then just keep raising the price. And at some point, you will develop the confidence that you will no longer put a price on it, and you will have a conversation about, well, what's this worth to you?
Couple of points there that are sort of nuances. One is that I wouldn't have a sales conversation if I was selling productized services. Like right off the bat, I don't even do
just
that.
Buy it from my website.
Buy it, don't buy it, don't care. Yeah, it's not, you're not having a conversation. Somebody might email me and say, or emails to, like if you're having a sales conversation, then all of a sudden you're starting to undermine the whole point of it, which is like, hey, it's $1,000, it's $10,000, it's $25,000. It's fine if you don't want it, but here's the box. Here's what it says on the front label. Here are the ingredients from the back label, and here's the price. And if you're not cool with that, that is fine. You can, instead of my $25,000 thing, you can buy my $2,500 thing if you want, or you can talk to me about a custom project if you want. But I'm not having I wouldn't be having conversations with people. A high touch sales for a productized service starts to make it not make sense to me.
Yeah, I think there's a semantics issue here. So let's just clarify. So the example I just gave of telling my client to double the price, that's really just fixed fee pricing.
Yes,
for,
I agree.
For what I would consider a standard service, and you could consider it quasi-productized. And that's my beef with the firms that I serve, and the digital firms in particular. It's like we do X, we have a price for X. And some people will go so far as to put those prices on their website. So they're stuck in the mushy middle. They're quasi productized.
Another thing you said that is definitely true, I wanted to call out, is that the main downside for me of productized services is that you are leaving money on the table. Like, you almost surely, if somebody is like cold buying a $20,000 thing off your website, almost surely you could have gotten more money from them. But, and this is to the previous point, but you didn't have to do any sales, none, yeah. Right? So if you hate doing sales and you don't want to get better at it and you don't want to hire someone to do it, you know, maybe you should just get a job. Okay, but you could just put it on your site at a price and be cool with leaving money on the table. And if that price is profitable enough, it should be extremely profitable. You should pump your fist and say yes every time you sell one. Like, it should be priced at least that high, but it's not value pricing.
It gets less profitable as the sales conversations drag on and on.
Exactly. There shouldn't be, right. There shouldn't be that. And I would say every time you, similar to you, every time you sell one or two, you can increase the price because you're attracting somebody or groups of people who think this is a good deal. And you're probably going to make it more efficient over time. So your profits are going to increase on both ends, meaning that your costs are going to go down because you're going to get better at it and maybe even take out things that nobody cares about that were a lot of work. And you can increase the price at any time. So you can grow it. It's not going to be exponential, but it's faster than linear. So it's like, it can be pretty cool. And if you're using that as a bridge from services, either from hourly billing into value pricing services, and you're just focusing on the kinds of productized services that we talked about, like these feeder things like a one-off phone call or, you know, subscription to, you know, your webcasts, something like that, or a roadmap, then that will feed naturally right into potentially into value projects that you could value price. Or you could be like, I don't want to do that. It's too risky. I don't like taking those risks anymore. I'm not attracting the kind. Oh, this is an important point. I'm not attracting the kinds of clients who get that much value out of what I do. So if you're not attracting big, rich clients and you're only attracting mom and pops, value pricing cuts both ways. It doesn't automatically mean you can raise your prices.
Yeah.
It could be that there's no value there because people see you as an undifferentiated coder. So it might be like, I don't know, dude, like, you know, what's different about you? What's special about you? Why are you, you know, you're not DHH. So like, why is somebody going to pay you a ton of money to solve this problem? So I think value pricing, really benefiting from doing value pricing, not only do you have to become good at sales and the performance art of that whole thing, but you need to be attracting the kind of clients who are going to be getting massive value out of the stuff that you do. So there are going to be big companies probably that have a large downstream benefit from your piece. So they're going to benefit. They have some kind of scale that you're going to amplify with your upstream strategy design, whatever piece that you're doing. They're going to get tons of benefit out of it. So it's worth a lot to them, or you're taking away a massive amount of risk, whatever it is. So it's going to be worth a lot to them, and it doesn't cost you that much. So you can have those order to deliver. So you can have those order of magnitude prices where, yeah, it's going to be sloppy and the scope is going to skitter all over the place, but that's fine because I'm getting paid $2 million for maybe a 2 month engagement.
Yeah. As soon as you build a product for the lower end of the market, put it on your website, you're positioning your offering as serving the lower end of the market.
You're right. You need it needs to be a conscious decision to go down market. So once, so I think if you are soloist billing by the hour and you're looking for a way out, sometimes I've met a 10% maybe of the students I've worked with are just naturals at it. They just have already been talking like this. They have high personal confidence. They see their prospects as peers and not bosses, and they can do it. And they're willing to walk. They have to also be willing to walk away from the deal. So if there's any stench of desperation, but one of my favorite Blair quotes, if there's any stench of desperation, or you need the gig, or you feel like you are lower status than your buyer, oof, trouble. But maybe 10% of the people I work with feel high status. They really know what they're doing and they believe it. And they're just like, yeah, and they'll walk away from the deal. Then maybe value pricing, and they're going to scale their profits up that way. But if they're not and they don't really want to, then it's like, well, let's talk about productizing and then going down to people you're more comfortable selling to and trying to build a really big base of the pyramid instead of living up at the very tippity top.
It's deflating to me to hear that, like to imagine 90% of the market that you or I serve can't do this and needs to go down market.
Oh, no. 10% of the people I meet are naturals. There's a, some percentage that can learn it, that does learn it.
I think the value conversation is so, it's so pivotal. Pivotal. I consider it to be the most valuable skill in all of business. I think
I
when you
agree.
learn to do this, you shift your focus from what it is that you're selling to how do you create value. It just feels so different to the client. It changes the dynamics. You get one or two victories under your belt and you see the possibility, you taste what this could be like. You are hooked. The average person is hooked. But you're right, it's tacit knowledge. It has to be learned. You can't. The longest chapter in my book is on value-based pricing, Master the Value Conversation. Or sorry, is on the books on value-based pricing, is on Master the Value Conversation. I spent the most time on that chapter. And at the end of it, I read it and I think, this isn't enough. You can't learn this from reading it in a book. I mean, some people can, like you would say that the 10% read this, I got this. This is so in tune with who I am and how I think. I just need the framework. I've got this. I think the other 90%, they need practice. Most of those need feedback on the practice. And if you fail in the first three conversations, you might never pick it up again. Right?
Yeah,
So you
it's like
need
trying
somebody
to.
behind you saying, no, come on, just tweak this. You can do this. Let's go again.
It's like trying to learn martial arts from a book. It's not going to happen without practice, right? So you have to practice it. So that means you have to have a bunch of leads so that you can practice it. I've never, have you ever found a good way to role play it?
The value conversation?
Yeah, like a
Oh
really
yeah.
truly effective way.
Yeah.
Cool. That's I
Yeah, I
that's
we do that in our training and I'm not even going to give it away. I feel like I split the atom on this. Like
Yeah, I can't figure it out.
the point of the point that it represents a fundamental shift in your thinking, where you really become client focused and value focus on value creation. People listening to this who haven't mastered the value conversation, they think, well, no, I'm client focused. I'm focused on value creation. And you're not. If you're selling time or you're selling products, you absolutely are not. And people go, yeah, maybe, but we pride ourselves here on being. And I have a role play of the value conversation where I prove to people, and I'm not even going to say what it is because it's one of my most valuable trade secrets, but they do this exercise at the end of it. I give them the framework at a very high level without much detail. And I say, we partner them up. Go have a value conversation on this topic. And it's the topics that's key. Mm-hmm. And obviously you don't give them enough time and you don't give them enough information. And you come back and it's like, what do you learn? And most of them don't realize what they've learned until I point it out. And it's like, and what I point out is it was all about you. It was all about you. And if you did it right, it wasn't about you at all. Like I like to say, and I talk about this in the book, I think, your subject matter expertise is what gets you to the table. It gets you to the value conversation, but then you need to let go of it. You need to let go of what got you there, your subject matter expertise, your ability to spot the patterns and jump ahead. Let go of that and then embrace the process, the framework, and adopt the Zen mind of the beginner. I am a blank slate. I know nothing. All I have is this framework. There's nothing I have to sell. I always say I can make you a better salesperson if I took everything away, everything that you currently sell away from you. So I'll give you a hint. Put them in a value conversation role play exercise where they're not selling what it is that they sell. Take their subject matter expertise away from them.
Yeah.
And then all they have left is the framework. All of a sudden, they focus on the framework and the client. And they have this really meaningful conversation. Yeah, there's nothing. That's all you got. And so some people worry, it's like, I've hired this new salesperson. They don't have enough subject matter expertise. I go, great. I think if you gave me like a deep subject matter expert versus somebody who has no subject matter expertise, that person with no subject matter expertise will do better faster more initially at the value conversation because the subject matter expertise isn't getting in the way. Mm-hmm. They're not jumping ahead to solutions because they don't know what the solutions are. Yeah. All they have is the framework and they're focused on the client.
Yeah. I 100% agree with all that for sure. So, but this, you know, we're more here to kind of explore how productized services fit into this. And if I could make an observation, tell me if you think this is true. I think the fact that you serve like cutting edge creative firms, it would be crazy. They're basically perverting their DNA to productize.
Yes.
But if you were talking to, if you were serving, I don't know, well, who you tell me, what would be an example of someone who does make sense to productize? Like data scientists or some mathematicians or something more like audio engineers.
Website design firms have to have a productized service for the follow-on, the maintenance, and it might include hosting, maintenance contracts, etc. That's mm-hmm. They don't have to, but that's a logical one. So you see a lot of web design dev firms who have this like trailing product after the customized service, and after some time, some of the revenue becomes easy revenue. You add some volume to that. That's can be fairly substantial. So that's kind of a natural one, but beyond that, so a highly creative firm. So take Wieden and Kennedy. So the highly vaunted, I think they're the world's largest independent ad agency. I just seen it highly, highly creative. The idea that they would productize would be absurd. Creativity mm-hmm. is the ability to see, to bring novel perspective to a problem, to think differently mm-hmm. about the problem. So wouldn't make sense.
But if I'm like an exterminator, like a pest control.
Yeah. And if you're an exterminator, your business is built for scale. At some point, it's like the E-Myth. At some point, you're going to hire other exterminators and train them how to exterminate.
I suppose. I'm thinking of the Bugs Burger example of like the guarantee. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but.
Bob's Burger?
But Bugs, what's it called? But I think it's called Bugs Burger. Bug extermination. Oh, we'll talk about it offline, but they have such an absurdly, their guarantee is so absurdly client friendly that they charge like 5x what you would normally charge. And they didn't scale by hiring employees. I mean, eventually they got bought by somebody that franchised them, but anyway, different conversation for a different day. What I'm asking is, Do you think that there is a vertical that where productizing makes more sense than like maybe ad agencies are just the worst possible kind of client or kind of business to try and productize because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, maybe SEO, PPC, search engine optimization, pay-per-click, like advertising. Those businesses might be more inclined to productization in my world. And there are sometimes the just standard rote services that are just so commoditized. So should you productize? No, you should get in a different line of work, I think.
Yeah, that is the other option. Yeah,
Yeah.
if it's commoditized. Well, I think one thing we've uncovered, at least I've uncovered, is that I wouldn't have been able to articulate this before, but I now realize that I see productized services as a transition. It's a transition from something to something else. I mean, I've certainly, when I was doing consulting still, mobile consulting, my main income for years and years and years was what I would consider to be a productized service, which was like a monthly advisory retainer. And it was like a scope and it was a price, and I didn't value price it. I just said it's 10,000, it's 15,000, it's 9,000, whatever it was for the situation. And I did great, but it was for a variety of reasons I got sick of it. But if I had to scale that, I don't know how I would have, because I could only handle my capacity was roughly three advisory retainer, clients. I did fine, I did well, but I wasn't like a millionaire. I wasn't making millions of bucks a year from it, and I couldn't have. So I would have had to go somewhere, and I surely was leaving money on the table for sure. But it was so easy. People just come to my site. They send me an email. They said, "Yeah, we want to do it," and we would just do it. It was like no sales at all. Because now this is before when I was doing that. This is before I understood a thing about positioning or marketing or growing the business. I was just copying stuff that I was copying stuff that I knew the name of, but I didn't understand. And So I don't know how I would have scaled that beyond where I was. I was super comfortable, but I don't know how to scale something like that. So I see it as a transition from, even if you're doing great, it's a transition either into probably value pricing for creative work, and I don't just mean designers or whatever,
Yeah.
or going mass market and having true products, where you're selling books and courses and membership communities and those sorts of things.
Yeah, I see your point of view. I suspect there are better interim steps. I just think the traps, like I think if you really I see productized services like they're there's this spectrum, fully customized, fully productized, two different businesses. And then in the middle is where I was as a consultant. It was like, okay, you got a problem? Yeah, I'll sell you. So somebody would say, as a business development consultant, somebody would say, okay, well, these are my challenges. And I would say, well, these are the three products I can sell you at these prices. I was like, but are we gonna get to the heart of, yeah, probably with this one. Okay, I'll buy that one. And my entire business was built on, okay, I'll buy that one, I guess.
Kind
And
of
then
no man's land.
I was at this inflection point when I started to learn about value-based pricing. I realized, I'm stuck in the mushy middle here. If I want to be a good consultant, I need to value price. I need to slow down. I need to have these conversations. I need to figure out what it is, that the client really wants and how much value can really be created here. And then I need to structure a more open-ended engagement. And the biggest, or I need to productize. And I chose productization and scale largely, I guess, two reasons. Number one, I was kind of a little bit bored as being a consultant. But number two, which was maybe the larger reason, I live in a remote mountain village in the middle of nowhere. I really believe that for me to do consulting properly, I had to be able to say to my client, listen, I'll be there Monday morning. And where I live, I can't, that's just not a thing.
Yeah,
I'll
right.
spend 2 days trying to get to where I'm going and then 2 days coming back.
Right.
So I didn't feel like my location allowed me to do that. Now, the truth is, like, I could have stayed with the model that I had and just kept raising my prices. And like my friend, but I was topping out at what I would look at other independent consultants and I would think, well, nobody can make more than this. My prices are high. I'm working as hard as I can. I'm getting sick 3-4 times a year traveling the world. This is as high as it goes. And now I look at it and people doing 3-4 times what I was doing. And obviously there are people out there doing multiples of that probably. But yeah. So my friend who's going to do 1.5 million this year, he lives in a location where it's like, it's so easy to travel. And then COVID hits. And what happens is like, now he doesn't have to travel at all. So now he goes from 1 million to 1.5 million.
Right.
And his costs go to zero.
Right.
I was trapped in the mushy middle, and I see these having some productized services with the exception of the ones that we agreed on.
Yep.
I see it as being in the mushy middle. It's like a transition. Maybe. And I hadn't thought about it as a transition. I recognize that that audience of your listeners here who are soloists, it is different. It is different. It's just you. And if you can't master the skill, maybe you have to go down market and productize, but you have the volume has to come from somewhere.
Yep. You still need you need volume at both ends. You're just going to say no to fewer people at the high end. I mean, you're going to say yes to fewer people at the high end. So
did we make any progress?
I did. Thank you for that. So I now realize that I see it as a transition step. I did not think of that before. And I wonder if people who have resisted it as an idea thought that I was saying, this is going to be your new business forever and ever. Amen. Because now if I frame it as a transition, either the few things that we've carved out as essentially gateway drugs into a value price project, or they're going to, you know, other than those, if you're going to do something else, it's probably just you transitioning, trying to get your time back so that you can build products at the other end of the spectrum.
Now, with software developers, there are actual products, right? Like you build a product for a client and you look around and go, wow, there are hundreds of clients like you, thousands. I could resell this. So
yeah,
I've seen
that.
Consulting firms, customized services firms build products. A great example is a friend of mine owns a business. Traction on Demand is the URL. It's a Salesforce.com consulting, cloud computing consulting, primarily Salesforce. Mm-hmm. They have developed many products. And if you look at go to their website, you can see all of these products that they've developed, but they've handled this properly. They develop a product, they spin it off into its own business. And they've done this with 4, 5, 6 products. Mm-hmm. It's a large business to begin with. But that's the way to do it. And at that size, you have to spin them off because the cultures clash. The culture of a product company clashes with the more innovative, more creative culture of a consulting company.
Right, because one side wants to get efficient and cut costs, and the other side wants the exact opposite.
It's scale, higher scale, lower margins, efficiencies become more important, systems become more important, managers become more important, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's another difference between our audiences is like most of my people have an engineering mindset, so they love the idea of creating efficiency.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. But in your business, you're going to be totally creative and you're going to be an artist and you're going to have this performance art conversation, this sales call.
You can't. You reside on this spectrum of efficiency on one end and innovation on the other.
Yeah.
And you want to embrace. So yeah, I guess from that point of view, it is a tendency of an engineer to want to systematize and productize.
Yeah, they love it.
But to make it work, you need scale.
Yeah, but if you're solo, you don't need that much scale to get over the hump, to swallow the fish. And then you're like, wow, I'm only working like 10 hours a week. So with that extra 30 hours, what can I do? And create more products.
I'm just smiling at the 10 hours a week. You and I have probably had goals of that too. And
oh, dude, when I was...
It's laughable.
Not for me.
Nope.
No, my average this year is 7 hours a week.
Oh, I've never hated you more than I hate you right now, Jonathan Stark.
I don't want to make more money. I want to work fewer hours. Next year, I'm
shooting for 4. Okay, this podcast is over. Even Tim Ferriss never made it to four.
Yeah, well, I'm cheating because they're like, I don't count this as work. Talking to you is not work. I don't count that. So I do a bunch of things like this that people would count as work. I have like four or five podcasts and I write a mailing list every day, but to me that's pure pleasure. And if I was retired, I'd be writing every day anyway. So I am cheating in the sense that I don't count things that benefit my business as work necessarily. It's just the one-on-one phone calls, that's work. But that's about it.
Okay, thanks for that. I work 90 minutes a week and I have to go into my 90-minute staff meeting right now to do my 90 minutes of work.
All right. Well, I will let you go in that case, but always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me again. Blair, where can people go to find out more?
Well, I really enjoyed this conversation as I enjoy all of our conversations, Jonathan. Thank you. So it's lots for me to think about too. Winwithoutpitching.com.
Awesome. Go there. Good stuff. All right, folks, that's it for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark, and I hope you join me again next time on Ditching Hourly. See you then.